Good evening, everyone. This is Kilo 6 Sierra United November, and this is South Cars, the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. This net is conducted under the guidelines of the South Cars organization and further follows the rules outlined in FCC Part 97 and Good Amateur Practice. This SCAR server is supplied by the Great Lakes Reflector System, provided by Kilo Bravo 8, Zulu Golf Lima, and all contacts and requests for information will be handled through the net control. When contact with another station is made, please move off the system and establish your contact direct so the net may continue. In fairness to all, short-time stations will not be recognized as such. All stations will be worked in the order in which they have checked in. Information regarding our HF operation may be found at www.southcars.com and for this digital operation at www.voip.southcars.com. Your net control for this session is actually Gary, KC2RMO. His location is probably Cold Syracuse, New York. My name is Kathy. My call sign is Kilo 6 Sierra United November. I'm merely opening the session this evening. My location is Vero Beach, Florida, where it's currently a temperature of 77. High today was about 80, low tonight about 68. And we do have some high wind out there, 20 to 30 miles an hour, but it's a beautiful evening. Prior to starting, I'd like to ask if there's any emergency traffic or anything out of the ordinary that needs to be handled at this time. If so, please come aboard. Hearing no emergency traffic, how about any of those birthday stations? Anyone celebrating a birthday last week or maybe this upcoming week that we can get you to come aboard so we can say happy birthday? Okay, we have no birthday stations either. You know, this is the South Cars VOIP Global Family Hour. The intent of this net is to encourage members, their families, and their friends worldwide to enter into an informal social net highlighting third-party traffic through the member station. Our program for this Saturday evening is a very special one, remembering the Edmund Fitzgerald. And we hope that if you have questions or comments, you were in that area at the time, you sure would check in. I want to advise everyone that I always record these sessions. So if you've been part of the session tonight, you will most definitely be part of the recording. And hopefully we can get it on our website as a podcast. But before I turn it over to you, Gary, I would just like to make a couple short announcements. So let me drop it here for a moment. You know, we're always looking for NCSs, the backups, people that will help South Cars, administrative, hospitality. So we ask that if you have that desire to just simply send us an email at voip@voipnet.southcars.com. We'll tell you where you can get that information, the training tutorials, and we hope to get in a conversation with you. You know, we had a net, I believe it was last Sunday, which we covered favorite foods and restaurants. During this net, it was suggested that in the next month or so, we should put on a net of favorite recipes. So I'm merely asking that if you have a favorite recipe and you're so inclined to send it to us, just simply send it to voip@voipnet.southcars.com or myself, Kilo 6 Sierra United November at voipnet.southcars.com. And we're hoping to have a very special net in the future. But I do want everyone to be looking at our website. There's some changes on our website. To the left, we have we're putting on staff biographies, so that way you know something about our staff. But please check out our website. So at this point, Gary, I'm going to turn it over to you, KC2RMO, to begin our program. And thanks for doing this evening. It's very special in my heart because I'm from that area. So KC2RMO, the gavel is all yours.
Thanks, Kathy. It's 42 degrees and drizzly here in Syracuse's beautiful Otter Comstock section. I want you to do me a favor and take a look outside your window right now and see what you see, and maybe it's the same thing that I see. And then think about this. The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. Superior, it's said, never gives up her dead when the scales of November come early. Whenever I look out my window, and see a steel gray November sky and see the trees bending in the wind. I go back to a day in 1975 that many of us still remember, and those who are too young to remember want to know more about once they've heard the story. The SS Edmund Fitzgerald was an American Great Lakes freighter that sank in a Lake Superior storm on November 10, 1975, with the loss of the entire crew of 29. When launched on June 8, 1958, she was the largest ship in the North America's Great Lakes fleet, and she remains the largest to have sunk there. Nicknamed the Mighty Fitz, Fitz or Big Fitz, the ship suffered a series of mishaps during her launch. It took three attempts to break the champagne bottle used to christen her, and she collided with a pier when she entered the water. For 17 years, the Fitzgerald carried taconite iron ore from the mines near Duluth, Minnesota, to the ironworks in Detroit, Toledo, and other Great Lakes ports. As a workhorse, she set the seasonal haul record six times, often beating her own previous records. Let me just buy a nickel for a minute. Captain Peter Pulser was known for piping music day or night over the ship's intercom system while passing through the St. Clair and Detroit rivers between Lakes Huron and Erie, and entertaining spectators at the Sioux Locks between Lake Superior and Huron with a running commentary about his ship. Her size, record-breaking performance, and the DJ captain endeared Fitzgerald to boat watchers all over the world. Carrying a full cargo of iron ore pellets with Captain Ernest M. McSorley in command, she embarked on her final voyage from Superior, Wisconsin, that's near Duluth, on the afternoon of November 9, 1975. En route to a steel mill near Detroit, Michigan, Fitz joined a second freighter, the SS Arthur M. Anderson. By the next day, the two ships were caught in the midst of a severe winter storm on Lake Superior with near hurricane force winds and waves up to 35 feet high. Shortly after 7:10 p.m., the Fitzgerald suddenly sank in Canadian waters 530 feet deep, approximately 17 miles, from the entrance to Whitefish Bay, near the twin cities of Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, and Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario. Although the Fitzgerald had reported being in difficulty earlier, no distress signals were sent before she sank. Her crew of 29 all perished, and no bodies were ever recovered. So that's the story in a nutshell. Perhaps you remember it. If you're of a certain age, you certainly do. You've probably heard the Gordon Lightfoot song too. And if you do, we'll take some check-ins right now and recount your memories of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. I'm KC2RMO. This is the Global Family Hour, and this is South Cars looking for check-ins right now.
Six Victor. Good evening, sir.
Lima, Charlie, Bravo, and good evening also.
Sierra United, November.
November, Foxtrot, Foxtrot. Good evening, Gary.
Well, hey, that's a great first round, and hello, everybody, and we'll get things going with Six Victor. Hello there to you, sir, and come on aboard and join us on the Global Family Hour.
All right, Mr. Syracuse, thank you, sir. Appreciate you being here. Gordon, KY6V, Central Florida. Currently about 66 degrees. It's been a grand day down here, Gary, but a little on the windy side, but that's the way it is at the moment. Been reading the admin text box, and we'll talk about that later. Very fascinated with the subject that you have here tonight. A lot of questions, a lot of no answers, because they've been deliberating this ever since it happened in 1975. I guess one of my questions, and I don't remember the length of this ship. I thought it was a little over 200 feet, but I heard somebody say today, one of our members up there in the UP that was pretty close to the situation, said this rascal was 700 feet, not quite up to 1,000. So that was one long ship. And there's a lot of thoughts about what happened, why it went down, whether it got too close to the shoal there at White Point, whether the couple of large waves that came over the ship attacking them from the stern made them capsize. Let me buy a nickel here for a moment. And I'm not looking for any answers tonight because I don't think there are going to be any answers other than, you know, everything that's happened in the past and the conjecture. But where was the radium in? You had to have a radium in on that baby. I know that the captain was talking with the other ship. What was it, the Anderson, Gary, or something like that? And they were in communication, but where was the radium in? I didn't see anything in any of these reports giving position reports of where they were and where things were standing at the moment. And why wasn't there an SOS at the last moment? Or did these waves just come in and infiltrate the ship, roll it over, capsize it, bury it, and the radio men couldn't work the Morse code key upside down? Who knows? Thanks, Gary. KY6V, back to net.
Hey, thank you, Gordon. And it really is good to hear from you tonight. You have brought a couple of interesting points to light. And the first thing, yes, this sucker was huge. It was bigger than 700 feet. It was actually, I think, 738 feet. So that's, you know, it's about an eighth of a mile, a little over an eighth of a mile long. That's a mammoth ship. It really is. I mean, so. Obviously, when you got a lot of forces working against you, you know, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. And I'm not gonna really mention what's coming up at the end of the net, but there are some new theories that prove out pretty well about what happened to that ship, and it is not what a lot of people thought. It is what some people thought, though. They never could prove it up until now. So. I'll leave that hanging, but there is new evidence that suggests an interesting end to that, and it accounts for the reason that it sunk so quickly. This happened very, very quickly. The Anderson was in contact with the Fitzgerald. The last he had from him was he had some water coming in, but he was holding his own. It was just a mild leak. There was no problem for sure. And the next thing you know, they couldn't make contact with him. It was a matter of minutes from that last transmission. So when you think about it, it had to been, you know, it takes a long time for a ship to sink. It really, you know, this happened like lightning. So there's a reason for that. There's a reason for that, and we'll be getting to that a little bit later on. So stand by on that one. And again, great to hear from you tonight. We're going to go with Lima Charlie Bravo. George, hello there. Come on aboard.
Well, good evening, Gary and KW4. Lima Charlie Bravo sitting out here in the porch taking the breeze tonight there. Beautiful sky. Or just, I was just wondering, if I remember in Lightfoot's a song there, it was there was a reference made to temperatures being cold there. You know, really can testify to wave formation and condition, you know, in the Great Lakes there. I have read a book or two and heard a story or two, but I've never put a dog in that race, but I have dealt with them in the ocean there, so and they can be brutal. And if cargo shifts, you know, it can cause a problem, or, you know, if a wave catches you on the downside of things, you know, you could do a flip-flop, or, like I said, if it catch you in a lean, and then get slapped in the side. So, You know, pretty much like Gordon said, there's a whole lot of things that could happen. KW4 Lima Charlie Bravo, and thank you for doing the show.
Hey, thank you, George. And certainly, you're no stranger to the water. You know how these things go. So, when you have a big ship like this and some severe weather, you know, anything can happen. You know, you would think the size of the ship is going to keep you safe, but sometimes I think it can be a hindrance as well. And you'll understand why when we're talking about this latest discovery about what happened. I finally got this microphone the way I want it. I was listening to port earlier, and it's like it's a little bit better. So I don't think I probably don't sound so echoey now, and that's okay. But yeah, it was a cold night when they were out there. It was there was ice forming on the decks. It was rough. It was a winter storm. Even though it was this time of year, it was an early winter storm, and it was a fierce one too. There were waves that were up to 35 feet high, and it was a very strong wind. I think I had heard in some of the things that I had researched that those winds were almost as high as 100 miles an hour. So really, you know, that was a rough night, and by anybody's estimation, but it took its toll on the Fitz. But it was a very, very severe storm. You know, many theories. You know, Gordon was talking about that. Many theories, books, and expeditions examined the cause of the sinking. We're going to get into those when we go back. But right now, we'll check in with K6SUN. Kathy, come on aboard.
Well, good evening, Gary, and first of all, I want to say happy birthday. I know your birthday is on Thursday, the night of our TIN, so I wanted to say happy birthday. But you and many others know that I was born and raised in the state of Michigan. However, when the sinking took place, 1975, I was living in the state of Oregon. But I remember it quite well. I have visited the site and the museum quite a bit. Whitefish Point has a lighthouse there, and it's a very dangerous part of Superior, and I believe there's a lot of wrecks pretty much in that area, but this one is famous. I believe it sank probably 500 and some feet, but you know, I remember there is a dive site on that, and I had often thought of diving it, but that's way further than I want to dive, but I think they've made it a dive site. But, you know, it's a treacherous area of Superior. And it was cold. You know, this time of the year up there, it starts getting very cold, and that area is very cold. But, you know, I just am glad that you did this evening. It brings back a lot of memories. I believe the winds were 70 miles per hour, as far as I can remember. But there's a lot of information out there, and I'm looking forward to what you have to share with us. But as a ex-Michigander, this has brought a lot of memories back for me. And today we had a person on the net who couldn't be here tonight that shared a lot of information with us. So hopefully you'll share that with us too. But I'll turn it back to you, Gary, KC2RMO, and hopefully I can come back aboard. But happy, happy birthday next week.
Hey, thank you, Kathy. That is a dive site. It is a dive site. And I was going to ask you about that, you being a diver, whether you had ever attempted to take that trip down there. It is deep. It's 538 feet down. I don't know enough about diving, but I would expect you might need special equipment for that. It sounds pretty deep to me, anyway. I guess you have certain certifications for diving, and there's different techniques. You certainly could tell us more about that, but maybe someday you'll end up doing that. That might be interesting to see. The ship, if you look at it in some of the pictures, if you look on Google and what have you, it's in two pieces, and it's relatively intact. So there's a lot to see. You really can get a good image of the ship if you do dive. Interesting, very, very interesting, and that was a rough night. And like I was saying, that was sustained winds of 60 to 70 miles an hour, and we also had reports of gusts of up to 100 miles an hour. So not a good night to be out on Lake Superior, that's for sure. Hope you come back and tell us more about maybe how it would be to dive that site or anything else, about remembering that night back in 1975. I can kind of remember, just in thinking about it here, I can remember watching the news, and I think it was Harry Reasoner on ABC telling the story of the ship and how it just kind of disappeared. And at that point, there was... No survivors. I think they found at that point a life jacket or a lifeboat. You know, just some very small amount of debris from the wreck. But it was a big mystery right from the get-go. And of course, the subject of a lot of controversy. And we're going to get into that in just a little bit. But right now, we will check in with NFF. Come on aboard, sir, on the Global Family Hour. Let's hear from you right now.
Well, good evening, Gary, to you and everybody else on, but this is Doug. My full call is N6NFF, November 6, November Foxtrot, Foxtrot. My South Car's number is Echo 1874, and I'm here in Sacramento, California, where we presently have 73 degrees. I remember the night that the Edmund Fitzgerald went down very well. I was living in Cleveland, Ohio at the time. And the thing that I learned about the Edmund Fitzgerald was it was built by the American Shipbuilding Company of Lorain, Ohio. That's a company that is no longer in business. But that is the company that built the Fitzgerald. And the company that sold them the engines, the Caterpillar Marine engines that powered it, was a company called Ohio Machinery Company. Right down the road from where I lived. In fact, I worked there. I ran the lunchroom at that company. And they are the ones that sold American Ship the engines, and they are the ones that took it out to sea trials. Well, I heard about the wreck on the 11 o'clock news that night. For some reason, I decided to stay up and watch the news. I usually didn't do that. Usually, I was in bed by 10:30. But I did watch the news that night, and I went to work the next morning. And all of the people there at the company were crying and very sad and very somber. In fact, one fellow came up when he bought, a Pepsi from me. He always did early in the morning. But he bought one. And the only thing he would say to me was, I took that boat out to sea trials. Apparently, he was one of the ones that took the boat out when it was on sea trials. So at that company, a lot of people had memories of that boat because of the fact that they sold to American Ship the engines that powered it. Let me reset the timers. Here is N6NFF. Harkening back to Gordon Lightfoot's song, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, which I like, he says in his song that it was headed for Cleveland. And you had said, Gary, in your report, at the beginning of the net that it was headed for Detroit. So wonder who, but perhaps Gordon Lightfoot was the one that got it mixed up. But I guess the Fitzgerald had visited the Port of Cleveland on numerous occasions. Well, that's my take on the story. I remember it every November, and of course there's a special event station for amateur radio that's operated by the Stillwater Amateur Radio Association around this time every year commemorating the wreck of the Fitz. So, Gary, that's all I have. I'll say 73 and turn it back to you. This is N6NFF.
Hey, thanks, Doug. That is great. A personal connection to that is remarkable. And wow, what that must have been like to have that come to reality with all the folks that were so close to it. It was headed for Detroit, but Lightfoot could be right too. I mean, it was certainly on the list of ports. It kind of made the big Great Lakes ports, Detroit, Cleveland, Toledo, the standard ports that any Great Lakes freighter would make. That's a possibility that maybe was going to stop at Cleveland and then head for Detroit. I don't know. Or vice versa. I do not know. But that's the way I had it anyway. So I guess we'll never really know, or we could do some more research on it and find out. But the idea being though that it just to hear the guy that took that thing out for its trial. Amazing, just amazing, and as this mystery kind of persists, and like I say, later on we're going to get into some of the reasons why they think it's sunk and the latest theory on it. It even adds a little bit more to it. So definitely great to hear from you, and that's some great insight. So hang in there, and we will be getting into it a little bit more. In depth of this story. If you're joining us late, we're talking about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald and not necessarily the song, but the actual event, the sinking of the ship and the story behind it. This of course is the anniversary of it happening. This was the day it put out, was November 9th. The sinking goes back to, is noted as November 10th, but the reasons are many. The theories about the reasons are many. The Fitzgerald may have fallen victim to the high waves of the storm, suffered structural failure, have been swamped with water entering through her cargo hatches or deck, maybe experienced topside damage or shoaled in a shallow part of Lake Superior. Gordon had been talking about that a little bit earlier. The legend of the Edmund Fitzgerald remains the most mysterious and controversial of all shipwreck tales heard around the Great Lakes. Her story is surpassed in books, film, and media, only by that of the Titanic. Canadian folk singer Gordon Lightfoot, we were just talking about him, inspired the popular interest with the vessel in its 1976 ballad, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, which, by the way, if you've never heard it, is a great song, and it absolutely captures the feeling of a shipwreck. It is a haunting song. If you play guitar, it's that magic chord that Lightfoot uses a lot. It's an A suspended second, and it is a spooky sounding chord, and just play around with it if you have a guitar. It's great. The Edmund Fitzgerald was lost with her entire crew of 29 men on Lake Superior at the request of family members. Her surviving crew, the Fitzgerald's 200-pound bronze bell was recovered by the Great Lakes Shipwreck Historical Society back on 95.
This is Kilo 6 Sierra United November. It looks like Gary has timed out, and hopefully he's going to come back very shortly. But, thinking back to the Edmund Fitzgerald, and he's back, so I'll let him continue. But I hope to share a little bit about the scuba diving, Gary, with you. But you timed out as you were reading us this information or telling us this information, so I thought I'd pick it up. Back to you, Gary, KC2RMO.
Hey, I heard you come back in just as soon as I unkeyed, and I knew I was in trouble. I don't know where I went away, but Kath, can you tell us a little bit about that dive site? Can you tell us about the scuba diving aspect of it? Because that's deep, 538 feet, and I don't know if the average diver can access that, can get down that far. Do you need special equipment? Do you need special training? Can you tell us about that?
Well, I will try, Gary, but I gave up diving about 4 years ago. It was starting to affect my ears. The deepest I went down here in Florida with some of their dive site was about 150 feet, and that was just with regular gear. So when you're diving a site like that, and you have to have that special gear, the special type of enclosed helmet. You can't do it with what you normally would do. So I haven't really looked into it, but I know there are dives, you know, that you can dive towards that ship. Now, whether it's the top part of the ship, I haven't seen how it's laying. If it's laying flat on the bottom of Superior, it's going to be a little difficult. But it depends on where the top of that ship is. It may only be at 150 feet. It may be at 200 feet. And it can be dove on. And, you know, I haven't talked to anyone that has done it. It was something I wanted to do, but I don't think I could stand the cold temperatures. You can only stay down in that water for a certain length of time. Or even down here in Florida when it's that far, your oxygen and what you're diving with will, you know, it'll just run out. So I didn't get the chance to do it. I had hoped to, but then I probably would have chickened out. Back to you, Gary, and I'm looking forward to what you have to share, but maybe check into just doing a search on diving. I've been trying to do that this evening. I do see some pictures, though, and it reminds me of the Titanic. Back to you, Gary.
Hey, thanks, Kath. I don't know. You're a braver soul than I am. I don't think I'd want to do that going down 538 feet. I wouldn't be in any hurry to do it. But it does sound fascinating. I think, as a matter of fact, one of the expeditions to the wreck actually used a mini sub. One of the interested people spent a lot of money. I forget exactly what it was like $100,000 to rent this mini sub and take some pictures and get some film. It just remarkable, some of the images that he came up with. But I would imagine that and it's got to be cold. It has to be cold. I mean, I don't know what the water temperature down at that depth would be, but it certainly isn't very comfortable. We're talking tonight about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, and we're taking some more check-ins right now. We'd love to hear from you. Your memories of it, or your thoughts about it, or any theories that you might have. I've got a couple of to throw out at the end of the net too. And anything you'd like to talk about in regard to that, we'd love to hear from it right now. So let's come aboard with check-ins on the South Cars Global Family Hour. I'm KC2RMO. Come on aboard.
Victor X-ray Papa.
X-ray Charlie X-ray.
Yeah, you had a couple of that time, and that's fine. We will go out to Ohio with Rick and VXP. Come on aboard, Rick.
This is N1 VXP. Yeah, actually born in Michigan. I had a couple of different times taking trips up to the Sault Ste. Marie area and also to Lake Michigan. And I've seen those ore carrying type ships. And I do remember, I had left Michigan back in 1963, so I wasn't there at the time when that happened, but I can remember in school hearing, I remember one day in the classroom, the teacher said, "Hey, we're going to talk about something out of the subject." And he had mentioned about the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald when it happened, and quite a story. I'll put in a website. I checked Wikipedia, and they seem to have a really nice website for information on that, and quite informative. But I could see where those type of ships that were designed for the Great Lakes would not be suitable for ocean going. And with the ocean going type ships were way too big to get through the locks. So kind of like their own little design of ore carrying ships. Let me drop for a second. But I have seen the that type of ships, and even the smaller ones are still quite large. And quite a sight to see them out there, and thinking that the Edmund Fitzgerald being so much bigger was quite a sight to see. Other than that, really not much else. Like I said, I'll put the link I found. Quite informative on the Fitzgerald. And 1-3-XB, back to net control.
Hey, thank you, Rick. And yeah, put that up there. If it's the one I'm thinking of, it is a very nice site. It's the it's kind of the official REC website, the official website for the families of the crew members that were on the REC. And it's a terrific site, very well done. And yeah, put it in the box if you could. If you've ever seen, and I don't know if how many folks have actually had the chance to see one of these ships. They are enormous. I had one. I had the chance to look at one in action a couple of years ago. We were taking a tour boat up on the St. Lawrence, and one of these things was coming through the St. Lawrence Seaway. It's so big. and this was, I don't even think this was even, you know, in the same class as the Fitzgerald was. It was enormous. It was, all you could see was ship. And it was just gigantic. And until you've seen one of these things up close, you really can't appreciate the size of this thing. So you just get lost in it. They're just absolutely mammoth. And when you think about what it could hold, this thing was hauling 26,000 tons of iron ore. That's a substantial cargo. Let me just buy a nickel. It's really remarkable. It really and truly is. We're talking tonight about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. This is the anniversary, of course. And let me tell you just a little bit about the journey, about what happened. With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty, that good ship and true was a bone to be chewed when the gales of November came early. The final voyage of the Edmund Fitzgerald began November 9, 1975, at the Burlington Northern Railroad Dock No. 1 in Superior, Wisconsin. Captain Ernest M. McSorley had loaded her with 26,116 long tons of taconite pellets, made of processed iron ore, heated and rolled into marble-sized balls. Departing Superior about 4:30 in the afternoon, she was soon joined by the Arthur M. Anderson, which departed Two Harbors, Minnesota, under Captain Bernie Cooper. The two ships were in radio contact. The Fitzgerald, being the faster, took the lead with a distance between vessels ranging from 10 to 15 miles. Aware of a building November storm entering the Great Lakes from the Great Plains, Captain McSorley and Captain Cooper agreed to take the northerly course across Lake Superior, where they could be protected by highlands on the Canadian shore. This took them between Isle Royale and the Kenawha Peninsula. They would later make a turn to the southeast to eventually reach the shelter of Whitefish Point. You can buy a nickel. Weather conditions continued to deteriorate. Gale warnings had been issued at 7 p.m. on November 9, upgraded to storm warnings early the morning of November 10. While conditions were bad, the winds were gusting to 50 knots and seas to 12 to 16 feet. Both captains had often piloted their vessels in similar conditions, so they weren't that worried about it at that point. In the early afternoon of November 10, the Fitzgerald had passed Mishapokaten Island. Say that 10 times fast. And approaching Caribou Island. The Anderson was just approaching Mishapokaten and 3 miles off the west end light. Captain Cooper maintained that he watched the Edmund Fitzgerald pass far too close to Six Fathom Shoal to the north of Caribou Island. Now, he could clearly see the ship between the beacon on Caribou on his radar set and could measure the distance between them. He and his officers watched the Fitzgerald pass right over the dangerous area of shallow water. By this time, snow and rising spray had obscured the Fitzgerald from sight, visible 17 miles on the radar. So what that kind of means is that it kind of shoots down the possibility that he might have hit the bottom when he went over the shoals. It says here that Cooper sees him going over that shallow point, so apparently he didn't bottom out at that point. He might have been too close to it, but he didn't bottom out. So for that part of the theory, it kind of shoots that one down. Let me just buy a nickel. To continue the story, at 3:30 in that afternoon, Captain McSorley radioed Captain Cooper and said, "Anderson, this is the Fitzgerald. I have a fence rail down, two vents lost or damaged, and a list. I'm checking down. Will you stay with me till I get to Whitefish?" McSorley was checking down his speed to allow the Anderson to close the distance for safety. Captain Cooper asked McSorley if he had his pumps going. McSorley said yes, both of them. As the afternoon wore on, radio communications with Fitzgerald concerned navigational information, but no extraordinarily alarming reports were offered by Captain McSorley. About 5:20 in the afternoon, the crest of a wave smashed the Anderson's starboard lifeboat, making it unusable. Captain Cooper reported winds from the northwest by west at a steady 58 knots with gusts 70 knots and seas of 18 to 25 feet. Those are high winds. According to Captain Cooper, about 6:55, he and the men in the Anderson's pilot house felt a bump, felt the ship lurch, and then turned to see a monstrous wave engulfing the entire vessel from astern. The wave worked its way along the deck, crashing on the back of the pilot house, driving the bow of the Anderson down into the sea. Then the Anderson just raised up and shook herself off that water, roof, just like a big dog. Another wave just like the first one or bigger hit us again, and I watched those two waves head down the lake towards the Fitzgerald. And I think those were the two that sent him under. This again from Captain Cooper. Let me just buy a nickel. So now we're beginning to see the conditions that were out there that night and how a ship like this could sink so quickly. It may not be, though, what you think it is. And we've got some theories coming up to address, but right now we'll take some check-ins. Anybody checking in right now, we're talking about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald tonight on the Global Family Hour. We'd like to hear from you. I'm KC2RMO, and this is South Guards.
Sierra United, November.
6, Victor.
Okay, we've got Kathy, and we've got Gordon, and we'll do ladies first. Come on aboard, Kath. Let's hear from you.
Well, thank you so much, Gary. But I want you to pick up Woody first. You forgot him. He was the next check-in, and then come back to me. Some very interesting information. But pick up N5XCX, Mr. Woody in Mount Dora.
You're absolutely right. And I'm going to have to walk the plank for that one. Woody, I'm terribly sorry. You're a victim of my notepad. You were on the left, and everything I was reading was on the right, so I am sorry. Come on aboard, Woody XCX. Come on aboard and join us.
That's all right, Gary. I understand. I'll let you get away with it this time. No problem. I didn't. I was just going to comment real quick. I'm checking in only. I don't have much to say. I was just going to comment that, you know, I grew up in Texas, and we were, let's see, 75. We were in the Houston area about that time, and we heard absolutely nothing about it. You know, it was like a Midwestern thing, and the news didn't even reach us. You know, I think we heard something on the radio a comment. So that's really amazing that there was nothing about it. But anyway, I'm wondering if the Great Lakes, that Lake Superior, especially that big ship was on, is as big. It sounds like it's getting some of the, you know, big enough to get some of the ocean storms. So I'm wondering if it's as big as some of the smaller oceans, you know, like the Indian Ocean or whatever. What do you think there, over?
Well, Woody, that's a great point. And when you consider by volume how much water there is in the Great Lakes, and I have the statistic here a little bit later on. Let me just see if I can find it Let me rattle some papers here while I'm talking. But I believe the figure, yeah, it's 21%. 21% of the world's fresh water, of the world's water of supply of surface water, not just fresh water, but 21% of the world's supply of fresh water is contained in the Great Lakes. So that's a lot of water. That is a huge volume of water. And although storms on the Great Lakes are not traditionally as severe as storms are on the ocean, they all have their unique idiosyncrasies too. That they can be particularly violent for a briefer amount of time than say an ocean storm would be, due to the nature of the lakes themselves. You know, 500 feet of water is really deep. Obviously, oceans go much deeper, and the dynamics in a quote shallower body of water are quite different. But you have, in this particular case of this particular storm, winds that were, you know, in the 70 to 80 mile an hour range with gusts up to 100. You had waves that were about 35 feet at times. Let me just buy a nickel. So, you know, this was a bad storm by anybody's estimation. So typically, the weather on the Great Lakes can be very rough for ships. I believe, again, this is a little bit later on, I had that statistic, but if you go through the years of record keeping, estimates are between 6,000 and 10,000 ships have been lost on the Great Lakes. So they are not without a degree of danger to navigate, that's for sure. So thank you for checking in, Woody. It's always a pleasure to have you there. We'll turn it back to K6SUN. Kathy, thank you for standing by.
Well, Gary, thanks so much for picking me up. I was born and raised in that area you're talking about. It's a very beautiful area. But during the wintertime, the Superior is very, very dangerous. It's very, very cold. So at this time, when the Fitzgerald was traveling on it and went down, you know, just like the Titanic, how long was it going to take before anyone that could survive would get hypothermia? But if you haven't visited the state of Michigan and the Sioux Locks up in that area, that's where the ships travel through as they travel through the lower lakes through Superior. It's quite an event to see, and then you can see the size of these ships. It's not as easily accessible as it used to be. You used to be able just to go and watch those, but now you have security to go through. And there is a history behind the Sioux Locks. You know, goes way back to the war. But if you haven't seen that, it's quite an event to see the Sioux Locks and to see these ships, these cargo ships. But thinking of the Fitzgerald, it was 730 feet long, and the depth that it sank was 500. So it was longer than that depth. So if it had gone straight down, Gary, head first, part of it would still be out of the water. But I wonder what Gordon was saying of the radio equipment. You know, we hear about a lot of the wrecks that the radio equipment failed or they weren't watching. So I'd be very curious if you have information on that. Maybe their equipment failed and why they weren't watched a little closer. So with that, I'll turn it back to you. But I will tell you, it's a cold, cold lake up there. Back to you, KC2RMO.
Yeah, I have heard stories about people, and I think it was Gordon was talking about that. Hot summer day, and somebody he was up by Superior, and hot summer day, and somebody said, "Well, let's go swimming or something." And he put his foot in the lake, and he said, "There's no way I'm going in there. It was freezing." Yeah. So, and that's in the summer, you know. So I cannot even imagine. We have our Great Lake, Ontario. Ontario is relatively warm by comparison. It's a it warms up, I guess, probably by the 4th of July. You can swim in Ontario. It's a little cold by then, but you know, good swimming in Ontario is probably in August, at least around here, in this part of the lake. But Superior, I don't think it ever warms. That's for sure. As far as going down head first, boy, that would be something to see the stern of that ship sticking up through the water. Really would be something. But there is no doubt that the radio equipment was working okay on that ship, because McSorley and Anderson were in radio contact until minutes before the ship went down. They were, I believe the last contact was about 7:10 that evening, where he reports that we're holding our own. And it just kind of sounded like a business-as-usual transmission. There was nothing really outstanding going on at that point. And then silence. He checks in about 10 minutes later, and nothing. They can't find him on the radar. They can't contact him by radio. Nothing. Just by a nickel. But I believe there's a reason for that. We're going to get to that in a little bit, but right now we'll pick up KY6V. Come on aboard, Gordon.
Okay. Thanks, Gary. KY6V. Let me correct one thing. When I stuck my toe in, it was Lake Michigan, not Lake Superior. That was about June 1st, and I said, no way. I imagine it would have been colder up there in Superior. To answer or suggest an answer to Kathy's comment, I think the radioman was so surprised. It was instant combustion. Whatever happened to them was so fast that they couldn't get out in SOS. That would be my guess. We had Mike on frequency earlier today, Gary. That's KE4IL. He lives up there in the Upper Peninsula. Was certainly around when this happened with the Fitzgerald, which happened probably about 100 miles away from him. He's in Marquette, Michigan, and he was giving us some statistics today. Let me buy a nickel. He was saying Lake Superior, as you've already indicated, is one of the largest lakes, or the largest freshwater lake in the world, second only to a lake in Russia, a Siberian locale, as I recall, that is as big but not quite as deep. And he said that if you were to drive around Lake Superior, it's 1,300 miles on the perimeter of the lake in order to drive around the whole dude. And I can't recall exactly what he said, but it was somewhere around, maybe it was 1,300 to 1,500 feet, is the deepest part of the lake. So this is a huge spot in the world, Gary. KY6V, and back to you.
Thank you, sir. They are huge. These lakes are enormous, and you illustrate it very vividly when you say to go around that lake is 1,300 miles. That's half the distance across the United States. It's a big lake. It really and truly is. And I just wanted to digress for a minute and go back to something Kathy was talking about a little bit earlier, was the Sioux Locks. If you have a chance to visit the Sioux Locks, do it. I have not done it. I have always wanted to do it. That's kind of fascinated me. I've always held a fascination with them. There is a website for the Sioux Locks. You can actually watch what's going on through a webcam and follow it that way. It's delayed, again, because of security. There's a big security interest there at the Sioux Locks. So you can't see it in real time, but you can at least see the delayed broadcast of it. Very interesting to watch it, and even better to go and see it in person. One of these days I'm going to do it, and I'm thinking that would be just great. But, yeah, Gordon, they could not react in time. There was just no way that they could react. It all happened very quickly. I don't know what the average time for sinking a ship is, but I'm going to say it was, it takes hours for a ship to sink. This thing sunk in a matter of minutes. It went down very, very quickly. Let me buy a nickel, and we're going to talk about that. The ship was the pride of the American side coming back from some mill in Wisconsin. As big freighters go, it was bigger than most, with a crew and good captain well seasoned, concluding some terms with a couple of steel firms when they left fully loaded for Cleveland. And later that night, when the ship's bell rang, could it be the north wind they were feeling? What happened? One thing is clear, the storm that battered the Fitzgerald was a monster, whipping the 729-foot freighter with the hurricane-force winds and massive waves. Tom Farnquist, executive director of the Great Lakes Shipwreck Historical Society in Whitefish Point, says he's heard the blame cast on everything, including giant waves, UFOs, and sabotage. I still can't come up with a smoking gun, he says. It's still a mystery. An official Coast Guard report concluded that the wreck was caused by faulty hatch closures that didn't prevent waves from entering the Fitzgerald's cargo hold, perhaps even unobserved by the crew. The flooding occurred throughout the day of 10 November, and the ship suddenly plummeted to the bottom of Lake Superior before Captain McSorley could even issue a distress call. Other theories still abound. Inoperative radars and faulty maps caused the Fitzgerald to run aground on the bank of uncharted shoals before the crew could do an about-face. Hence, the big ship suffered bottom damage so severe she was immediately flooded and sank abruptly. The National Transportation Safety Board discovered the most convincing evidence some time ago. Underwater cameras extensively investigated the Fitzgerald, and the NTSB's report was at the time the final word on what caused the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. The ship was loaded with taconite iron ore, and that is extremely porous. This absorbent cargo must have taken on enough water and weight that during the huge waves and winds of the gale caused the Fitzgerald to capsize and sink. Let me buy a nickel. The NTSB's investigation contradicted the conclusion that the hatch doors were insufficient. To the contrary, remote underwater cameras indicated the cargo hatch doors were in perfect condition. Those that disagree with the NTSB's findings believe it would be impossible for the crew and the captain of the big ship not to notice that the ship was becoming waterlogged enough to cause it to capsize. The NTSB countered that this would not be an uncommon occurrence during bad weather, when it was difficult for a crew to notice the very gradual settling of a big freighter. We buy a nickel. There is, however, a new and very exciting theory as to what sank the great ship. We'll look at that, but first we'll take some more check-ins as we continue with the Global Family Hour. This is South Cars, and I'm KC2RMO.
Six, Victor, sir.
Victor, X-ray Papa.
That worked out perfectly. I had a chance to get a drink of Diet Pepsi. So that worked out well. Six Victor, go right ahead, sir.
Yeah, thanks, Gary. KY6V. I just wanted to add something, see if you had any comments on it. Everything that I've read on the Fitzgerald shows no blame to the captain at all. You know how you have an airplane crash? It's pilot error, right? If you recall a situation a couple of years ago over close to Italy where the ship was showing off, they claim, and got too close over the shoals and ripped its bottom out. I have seen no blame to this captain, and you have already said that he was a seasoned dude. So any comments on that, Gary? KY6V, over.
Well, yes, actually, there is some commentary to supply on that. And McSorley was a very seasoned captain. He had, I'm going to say, about 30 years' experience as a Great Lakes captain. He knew what he was doing, but there were some stories that McSorley was not gentle as far his navigation of ships. He was a rough weather captain. He didn't fear it, and he figured the ship would see him through, and he took what some believe to be unacceptable chances in his navigation. Having said that, he never had a problem in his 30 years. So, you know, it could be one man's opinion. There was very few references to that. I think it came up only in a couple of cases. But generally, he was a well-respected captain. Knew what he was doing and, you know, the whole thing. And like I say, with 30 years service, he didn't have a mark on his record. So, you know, he was, I'm inclined to believe that there was not an error on behalf of the captain in this case, and especially what we're going to bring up in a minute or two. I don't see that as you know, the case. I think he was inclined to take a risk, and I think he was inclined to challenge the weather, but I don't think that was the cause for the sinking of that ship. And we shall see what we shall see. But right now we will go back out to Ohio, and Rick and VXP, come on aboard, sir.
This is N1VXP. One little comment about the Lake Superior. After I'd heard, you know, the size of the lake, I remembered, I thought it was much bigger as far as the shoreline. So I did a little search. Shoreline is actually 2,726 miles. Average depth is 483 with a maximum of 1,333 feet. So quite a big, larger lake than what had been mentioned. And I remember part of that, hearing that in school when they were talking about the Great Lakes. They were saying that the Great Lake was actually almost like an ocean, being that it was the largest, or the not only largest, but the deepest Great Lake. But I think you mentioned on the Edmund Fitzgerald something that McSorley reported. I remember also reading this, that he had reported losing two of his vent covers, and it was taken on water, and he felt the bilge pumps were holding pretty well, and he had to slow his ship down so Anderson could catch up to him. Let me drop for a second. And I remember, oh, several years ago, or a couple of years ago, there was a, I don't know which cable channel it was, that they did a special on the Edmund Fitzgerald. And it kind of made me think about, well, if the ship was actually carrying a bit more water than what they had estimated, that a... I consider it more like a rogue wave, which is something you see out in the ocean, but probably could happen in the Great Lakes as well. A large wave could hit them broadside, and that broadside wave would actually kind of tilt them sideways, so they actually roll into the water itself and completely submerge the ship. I have a feeling that may be... That to me sounds more like a plausible idea of how it sank, why there was no chance for anybody to report anything, because it was so quick, and, you know, even if it didn't sink immediately, they probably would have been pretty well concerned with trying to recover in a way that they could make a report out, but it was too late for the ship to actually sink right on the spot. N1VXP, back to net control.
Rick, I think you've got my script. I'm going to tell you about this in just a minute. The wind in the wires made a tattletale sound when the wave broke over the railing, and every man knew, as the captain did too, 'twas the witch of November come stealing. The dawn came late and the breakfast had to wait as the gales of November came slashing. When afternoon came, it was freezing rain in the face of a hurricane west wind. And Rick mentioned something that is very important to this whole thing. If you remember a couple of breaks back, I was talking about the captain on the Anderson talking about a wave that went from the stern of that ship all the way to the bow and shook it like a big dog and caused the bow of that ship to go down into the water. But the Anderson was able to stabilize. He saw that wave heading towards the Fitzgerald. Well, recently a new theory has emerged that reveals another potential cause of the disaster. It's a maritime phenomena known as a rogue wave, which is a giant wall of water that can reach heights as tall as a 10-story building. That's high. That's big. And that may have triggered the actual sinking. Once dismissed as a sailor's myth, rogue waves not only exist, they may occur far more frequently than once believed. Not only that, but apparently these things come in pairs or in groups of three. They're known as the two sisters or the three sisters. Let me just buy a nickel. Naval engineers, meteorologists, and wave experts have uncovered clues, ultimately taking their research to the world's most advanced ship simulators and putting their rogue wave theory to the test. The latest in maritime technology and wave science has recreated the actual storm conditions the night the ship was lost, and for the first time created a scientifically accurate and harrowing experience of the last minutes of the Edmund Fitzgerald and its likely encounter with a rogue wave. So if you think about it, if one of these had hit the ship, like Rick said, broadside, or what I kind of think happened was it was a double set of rogue waves, the two sisters, the three sisters. And if you can imagine them kind of like lifting the Fitz up where it collapses in the center section under its own weight. And then when you look at the wreckage, the ship is broken in two on the bottom, and the two halves of the ship are located relatively close to each other. So it makes sense that something raised that ship up and it broke in two under its own weight and sunk immediately. That there was a lot of the trough of those two waves would have been very deep. It really wouldn't have taken much for that to sink at all, with that much height on both of those waves. So it appears that they can pretty well prove now the conditions were such that it was a rogue wave that sunk the Fitzgerald. So what do you think about that? Apparently, all these years with all these theories, it was something even more out of the box than anybody had imagined. So apparently, these waves are real things. They've been proven. They've actually been on the ocean, in the open waters of the ocean. They've been filmed before. Let me buy a nickel. It happens in all bodies of water, apparently, and in a lake the size of Superior, I think you could expect to see some of the phenomena that happen on the ocean. So that's it. It was a rogue wave, apparently, and apparently they feel that they've got enough to stand on to call it that. So that's why we see no captain's error, and that's why the hatch covers are not an issue, so it all makes sense. So what do you think? We'll take one more round of check-ins here on the Global Family Hour. We'd like to hear from you right now. I'm KC2RMO, and this is South Cars.
Sierra United November.
Looks like Kath this time around, so let's hear from you, and come on board, Kathy. K6SUN, come on aboard.
Well, Gary, it looks like I'm sole this time. Nobody else wants to come aboard. But if you've ever seen the ships going through the Sioux Locks and you see how heavy they are, you know, they're right up, you know, just level with the water with all the ore and all that they carry. I can imagine this happening, something all of a sudden breaking that into, you know, they're so heavy. This ship was so, so long, and unfortunately it was a bad circumstance. But, and I think you'll say to us tonight before you close how many shipwrecks there are underneath Superior. It's a It's a very dangerous lake, very cold lake, but it's a very dangerous lake this time of the year. And you know, they usually stop ships going through those locks about this time when the ice starts to build up, because it is dangerous. You know, before I see that George has a check-in as well, so maybe I double with him. Let me drop it here a moment, and I just really have one final comment for you. You know, Gary, I've been diving in the Atlantic a lot, and I'm sure George has the same, and I've been in the experience of some of those very high waves, some of your dive captains that take you out and take you out in some very high waves. I was in some waves that were about 12 feet high diving. You know, experienced diver, but still, you see those waves and you really wonder. I've been in a small boat with those waves, not thinking I would be. So I can only imagine seeing a 35-foot wave come up and what may have happened. I did want to check in with you as a final check-in, just to encourage everyone to join us for the Sunday morning Rag Chew as well, celebrating Veterans Day. But I will turn it back to you. Don't forget George. He wants to check in. This is Kilo 6 Sierra United November. Back to you, Gary, and thanks so much for running the net this evening.
Thanks, Kathy, and you can't forget George, period. That's all there is to it. Just to put what you had said into perspective now, when you think about this, just do some numbers for a minute. If you figure the story of a building is 11 feet, and I believe that's what it is, 11 feet per story. And if a rogue wave can go as high as 10 of those, that's a very tall wave. That's 110 feet. If you have a couple of those, and you have a ship carrying 26,000 tons plus the weight of itself, and it is lifted by a pair of these things, you can see how this would cave in on itself and immediately go down, that the force of these waves would actually drive it down. So it's a very plausible theory. And up until recently, these things were dismissed as sea stories. You know, sailors would talk about these things, but nobody had been able to either prove one scientifically or actually get an image of one. Since then, both of those things have happened, that they have proved the scientific validity of rogue waves, and there have been images of them. So it makes perfect sense. I think there was, and I'm trying to remember too, you know, that I guess Siberian lakes are becoming a big topic tonight. Let me just buy a nickel. I think this thing was in Siberia, but there was a massive destruction on one side of a lake in this area, and I'm thinking Siberia, but you know, I'm not sure. And nobody could account for it. There was no evidence of fire. There was no evidence of explosion. There was no evidence of anything of that nature. It is only the only thing that there was massive destruction for miles on one side of this lake. Trees were down, buildings were down, houses were down. You know, everything was wiped out. Nobody could figure out. And eventually what they had done is they had proved that it was a tsunami-like rogue wave, that this thing came up out of the lake at about 80 feet high or 100 feet high and just wiped out everything and just, you know, it just disappeared. So these phenomena happen. And you take a very, very large lake like Superior, it can behave just as erratically as any other body of water, and there's a lot of force involved there. So thanks, Kathy. We'll move it along to LCB. George, come on aboard tonight on the Global Family Hour.
Well, thank you again, Gary, KW4, Lima, Charlie, Bravo. Back earlier when you had, was talking about, you know, the captain, you know, most half-rate captains in a situation a bad weather situation, that would be, you know, one of the first things you do, you know, to secure everything on deck. And, you know, it, the ship being what it was, of course, it would be make sure all the hatches was tied down and secured, you know. So I kind of go along with you, you know, that's one of the first things you do. Even a common somebody didn't know what, you know, was going on would do that. So, you know, but I have been out there and rode those waves there. And, you know, sometimes when you get up on the top of the wave, you start coming down like a roller coaster. And you got to remember, too, at the bottom, it turns out. And you can't hold the wheel. I mean, you know, you break your arm and everything else trying to hold that wheel. But they got hydraulics and, you know, some of those big ships there to kind of take care of that. But, you know, between every way.
George, I think we lost you. You might have timed out, but come on back in because you were giving us some fascinating stuff there. So give it another try if you could.
Sorry about that. But, you know, as you climb that wave there, and that's just like climbing to the top of a peak of a roller coaster. And when you come down, you know, you're coming down at such a great speed. It's unbelievable. And, you know, trying to hold a helm, it's almost impossible. I have busted my arm up pretty good over it. So, you know, but I'm quite sure with a big ship, they got hydraulics and things like that. So, you know, but let me pause on this next one here. But, you know, the thing is, these waves, the way they're spaced and all, you know, as that water, that wave is moving up, there's that shallow spot in between. And you figure you coming down, you know, maybe that was 500 or 600 feet original, but, you know, when that wave has swept that water out and more or less flatlined it, and you come down, you're coming down fast and you're coming down shallower. There's a whole bunch of things, you know. All I can say, you got to ride that wave to know what I'm saying there, my friend. KW4 Lima, Charlie Bravo.
Hey, thank you, George. That's one heck of a ride, I can tell you. Man. And, yeah, you would know more about that than most human beings, okay? So, you know, I'm taking your word for it because, you know, you've got the credentials. And that's what I'm figuring, too. That's exactly the way I figured it, that if it was maybe two of these, you know, a pair of these large rogue waves that, you know, maybe they're not even 100 feet, but, you know, maybe you've got a couple of 50-foot waves. Back to back, and they hit you such that you know they hit you maybe in the bow of the ship. They come in 1-2, and then all of a sudden, like you say, you have a shallow trough in the middle, and your bow and your stern are elevated, you have all this force and you have all that weight, and it breaks the ship in half, and immediately you're down on the bottom, and then of course the waves pass. You go back up to the 538 feet of water over you, and you have 29 people dead. That's a very fast and very violent way to have that happen, and it makes an awful lot of sense when you look at how things happened. That it was just this immediate timeline where they were in contact, and then he disappears from radar, he disappears from voice contact, and it's a done deal. It was so rough that night. And thank you, George, by the way. That was great. It's one of these nights, maybe we'll do a net on sea stories and you know, just being out to sea, which would be, I think, a fascinating net. And I'd love to have you tell us some of the things that you have observed in your sailing days. It would really be great to hear. But what I was thinking about with the fits was that it was so bad that night. And if you listen, if you go like on YouTube, and you Google around, or you search around rather, for the Edmund Fitzgerald, you're going to find audio from the last moments of the fits, and you'll hear the transmission where McSorley is saying, "I'm holding my own," and blah blah blah. But what you'll also hear is let me just buy a nickel. What you'll also hear is they are talking to the Anderson, and this is the Coast Guard control talking to the Anderson, and they're asking him about what happened, and he's explaining to them what was going on, and they're asking him to go back and search to see if they can find any survivors or any debris or anything, you know, to give him a clue. And he's so reluctant to go back there, he's afraid of losing his ship. And it takes really a lot of pleading on behalf of the Coast Guard person that he's talking to. I guess he's the commander of the station. And not really pleading, but he just won't let go of asking him the question, "Will you go out and take care of this?" You know. And he's doing everything short of saying, you know, "Please go out and do it. You know, I don't care whether you survive or not." You know, but this guy really does not want to do it. Eventually, very reluctantly, he goes and just tries to do the best he can. But a bad, bad, bad night, and it had to be some of the most amazing scenes that anybody had seen on the water in a great time. So, with that said, let's take one last round of check-ins, and let's hear what you have to say. We're talking about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. This is the Global Family Hour. I'm KC2RMO, and this is South Cars.
Six Victor,
good to have you there, and come on aboard, sir.
Thank you, Gary. KY6V. Hello, George. You know, I was sitting back sort of smiling here, Gary. Knowing your aspirations, you and Stephanie, to come down here to the grand state of Florida from Syracuse. And after our conversation tonight, you would probably be safer staying up there with the snow and the weather and be in Syracuse. Remember that our average height down here above sea level is about 3 feet. Now, there are some areas that maybe have 80 feet, still not, still under that 100-foot wave. We've got two molehills down here in Florida, one in the Orlando area, one up in Tallahassee, that one is 316 feet above sea level and the other is, I think, 326. But you're liable to get swamped if you come down here, Gary, so you better think about this. And I enjoyed George's comments. Let me buy a nickel. You know, I've done my share of boating, and I was very active with the Power Squadron years ago. In fact, I taught communication in one of their chapters, but it brought back memories of pitch poling. You take your ship into these big waves, or your boat, or whatever you're in, and you want to take it at a 45-degree angle. You don't want to hit it straight on. What happens is your fantail, the stern, the rear end of the boat, comes out of the water. You loose your steerage because your helm's out of the water. The propeller's out of the water, and you're at the mercy of whatever's going to happen. So you take it at 45 degrees and try to come down the other side and stabilize when you get down. Think about moving from Syracuse, Gary, KY6V, back to net.
I mean, when you were talking about the altitude, I used to live 1,800 feet up on a hill in Atisco. And there were taller hills in that area, too. It's mighty low, Gordon. And that snow and cold, we're used to it. You know. Yeah, I don't guess you don't ever get used to it, but you get used to it, you know. But one of these days, there will be warmth for us. But I don't think we're going to find any 1,800-foot rises down there. But I can see how that would work. You know, you'd want to approach that at 45 degrees. That is going to give you some element of control. That's for sure. Yeah, everything's out of the water when you hit it straight on. And when you look at it again, the way that it sounds like the what happened to Fitzgerald was that multiple waves, you know, kind of took this thing and lifted it and just snap, broke it right in half. So it makes huge sense, especially the way, you know, you're telling it. So, yeah, well, some night we got to do that. I have never owned a boat. I would have loved to have owned a boat. I love the water. Let me just buy a nickel. But I love stories of the sea, and I love stories of sailing. And those who are of a nautical ilk, it would be a great net. So let's think about maybe some night we can do a seafaring network. It'd be pretty cool. Thank you, Gordon. And let's finish this thing up in a musty old hall in Detroit. They prayed, or Detroit, as Gordon Lightfoot says, in a musty old hall in Detroit. They prayed at the Maritime Sailors Cathedral. The church bell chimed, and it rang 29 times for each man on the Edmund Fitzgerald. The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down to the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. Superior, they said, never gives up her dead when the gales of November come early. Some sources say that 6,000 wrecked boats lie at the bottom of the Great Lakes. Others say the number is closer to 10,000. Either number would be enough to give anybody a healthy respect for the potential dangers of navigating a system that comprises about 21% of the world's supply of fresh water. We may never know what really happened. The only true witnesses are the 29 brave souls who lie at the bottom of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. Thanks for joining us tonight. This has been South Cars, the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. VoIPNet schedules and general information may be found on the voip.southcars.com website. Your net control for the session has been Gary, KC2RMO, saying 73, and closing this VoIP session. Thanks for your cooperation. This net is closed. Hello?